drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. When your child is too excited, when they're throwing a tantrum or can't calm down and sleep, how do you handle it? Do you try to calmly talk them down? Maybe impose a timeout? Maybe you're a little stressed yourself and demand that they get control of themselves? Dr. Stuart Shanker is the founder of the Merit Centre and the Self-Regulation Institute, and he believes that there is a better way to help children manage their stress. Stuart, welcome.
Thank you very much, Patricia.
So what is self-regulation?
It refers to how we manage stress. And there are ways of managing stress that are what we call growth ways of doing it, and there are constricting ways. So what we're looking at in self-regulation is good self-regulation, healthy self-regulation.
So what does healthy self-regulation look like?
This whole theory is based on some really exciting developments in four different sciences that we work with. And the most important one is brain science. And what we find is that when a child is regulated, calm, that you can actually measure this in the brain. You get these nice slow brain waves. And when they're dysregulated, you get very hyper-aroused, jumpy brain waves. So what we're looking at is the reasons why a child is having the problems that you mentioned. And we're really focused on figuring out what are the stresses that are tipping the kid over. These are quite often hidden stresses, things that we don't even think of as a stress.
How is this different from self-control?
Well, self-regulation is literally what makes self-control possible. They operate on very different parts of the brain. Self-regulation is something that is going on beneath the surface of the brain. It's deep inside the brain, something called the limbic system. And self-control is this idea that when you are, say, having an emotional meltdown, you can force yourself to stay calm. You can force yourself to resist a temptation. But of course, children really find that very difficult. And what we have been studying for many years now is if you can reduce the child's stress load, that not only does it become possible for that child to exercise self-control, but in most cases, there's no need for self-control. The troubling impulses simply disappear.
So where did this idea of self-regulation come from? What were you seeing in children that led you to start developing this theory?
I was trained by one of the greatest child psychiatrists of all time, Stanley Greenspan. And Stanley and I were looking at a child that was having tremendous problems really regulating his behavior. He was a young kid. He was about 5 years old. And he was having these wild tantrums and lashing out and stuff like that. And people were, you know, trying to use punishment and reward to control his behavior, and it really wasn't working. And in fact, the child was getting worse. So we started to look at what were the stresses in this child's life. They were very interesting. With this little guy, he was very sensitive to noise. So just being around other children in a noisy, crowded room was a significant stressor for him. And we began exploring techniques of reducing his stress load. And wouldn't you know it, the explosive behaviors simply stopped. We never had to work on self-control. Instead, we had to reframe. It led us to make a fundamental distinction between misbehavior and stress behavior. Misbehavior is something that a child can control if they choose. Stress behavior is not. And so we had to figure out, what are the signs of stress behavior? When can I tell that my child is starting to approach that peak of, say, having a meltdown? And what can I do before the event? And then can I actually teach this to my child?
How can I tell the difference between those ideas as a parent? How do I know when it's, you know, in their control?
So that, to me, Patricia, that's like the number one best question you can ask. And it turns out there's all these signs that we're sort of aware of, but maybe we ignore because in the heat of the moment. So let me give you a great example. When it's stress behavior, a child's voice changes. The pitch of their voice, the tone of their voice goes up a little. It becomes a little shrill. They may start to speak a little bit more quickly. So there are these vocal signs. Well, there are other signs. There are signs in their face. Their face starts to become a little pale. Their eyes start to dart a little. There are lots and lots of signs. And so what we do at the Merit Center is, you know, we'll teach all this. But at the end of the day, every child is unique. So it's really a case of mom and dad, you know, thinking about their child and before they react, pause. And so we teach, here's the single best thing we've learned. Before you react, ask yourself two questions. Why? And why now? And just asking those questions stops you from having, you know, this sort of automatic reaction where you go straight into punishment mode or yelling or, you know, different ways of ratcheting up the cost to the child. Instead, what we want to do is we want to say, well, if this was stress behavior, what might the stresses be? And what happens if I reduce those stresses and help my child? And this is absolutely pivotal to experience what it feels like to be calm. We're seeing a generation of children who do not know what calmness feels like.
Which is incredibly disturbing. You've been talking about stress. I'd like you to explain why your version of stress or what you're describing here may not sound like mine, because there's a technical definition, right? It's not just, you know, too many deadlines, I'm feeling panicked right now.
That's exactly right. So the technical definition of stress is anything that requires us to burn energy. And, you know, some stress is really good for us. We know that stress has what we call an arousing effect. It wakes us up. It makes us motivated. We want to take on a challenge. It's when there's too much stress, meaning we're burning too much energy. This is the scientific theory of stress actually goes back to the beginning of the 20th century, and they were looking at the stress of metals. And in fact, the original word stress was used to refer to how if you had, say, an airplane wing and there was too much pressure on it, the stress fractures that start to occur. And so the founder of this field, an American called Walter Bradford Cannon, argued that there's something very similar going on with the human nervous system. If we have too much stress, we are burning too much energy. And then guess what? If we're burning too much energy, then we don't have enough left over to regulate our emotions, to pay attention, to get along with other people.
You said before that we're seeing a generation that doesn't know what it's like to feel calm.
Yes.
Why do you think that?
Lots and lots of reasons. We are very concerned with the way a whole range of industries have capitalized on research that was done in psychology back in the middle of the 20th century on how you can trigger dopamine, how you can trigger this. It's a neurohormone, and it makes us crave things. It makes us seek things. And the problem is that it's not that hard to trigger dopamine. And we now have children being exposed to what it's called a hook model, all kinds of different ways of using the hook model. And so it's used in food, it's used in video games. And now stop and think about this for a second. I have a child that, let's say my child is, we had a very interesting experience in North America this past summer. A video game was released called Fortnite. And parents across Canada were complaining that their child had disappeared for the entire summer playing Fortnite. But the game itself makes no sense. It's really not very interesting. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on is they figured out in the game how to trigger dopamine. And the child is playing it to keep the dopamine taps going. The problem is this becomes a huge stressor. It's a stress because they're very tense while they're playing it. They're not doing other things they should be doing that restore self-regulation, things like exercise or music or art or just being in nature. So there are, I'm only mentioning a major aspect. There are many reasons why we think children are so overstressed, but we do feel children are overstressed because we are seeing a generation now that are exhibiting problems like chronic anxiety that in numbers that we've never seen before and in ages that we've never seen before. And these are signs of a nervous system that's just burning way too much energy on stressors. And so the very first step that we do in all of our work with kids is we help them experience genuine calmness, calmness that feels good. It's you cannot, you know, get a child to be calm by saying you need to calm down, go sit in your room. That doesn't work. This has to be a sort of we call it a balance that occurs in different levels of the brain, and the child cannot learn healthy ways of self-regulating until they have genuinely experienced calmness. And that does not mean sitting in front of, you know, playing a video game or whatever.
On RN, I'm Patricia Karvelis. Dr. Stuart Shanker is my guest in the drawing room, and we're talking essentially about child psychology. So I wonder, other than taking our children to you and going through this process, how can any average parent who is also dealing with the so-called stresses of life can try and achieve that level of calmness, or to get children to that special place of calmness?
Again, it's a great question. I'll tell you why. When we started to do this, we were totally focused on the needs of the child and how to raise, happy, healthy children. And almost right from the start, we realized that we couldn't do method is called self-reg, and we couldn't do self-reg for children until the adults had done it for themselves. We are an overstressed generation. The reason why this is so important is because if you are not yourself genuinely calm, you cannot be a calming influence for your child. Your own tension leaks out through your tone of voice, through your gestures. And for a young child, that's what they hear. They don't hear the words that you're saying. They hear the nonverbal communication. If you are doing your best to try to explain to them that they need to be calm while you yourself are very anxious, that's what the child hears. So what we started to do was in all of our, we run these at the Merit Center, we run foundations courses for parents and for educators. And we really talked about their self-regulation needs. And what we found was that the key to this program has now, it's swept right through Canada and it's now sweeping around the world, because we start with the needs of the adult. And now here's a shocker for you. We've been doing this with the elderly and discovered that their medical problems dramatically decline as they improve their self-regulation. So now we have several hospital programs that we're working on. So there is no point in the lifespan where this doesn't apply. And it turns out that if you don't start with yourself, you will find it very difficult to get your child into that balanced, it's called a homeostatic state.
Oh, you just made it so much harder, didn't you? You really did.
Well, yes and no.
So is there something specific that parents can do to start finding that place of calm themselves, that self-regulation? Because what you're essentially saying is you're modelling it, you're making it a safe, calm place. And if you can't do it yourself, exactly right. I mean, you know, any of us know that. And look, I put my hand up, I'm a parent. Yes, my kids are so smart, they actually look at me and say, "You seem really stressed and it's making me feel stressed." I mean, they'll actually say that.
How
and
old I'll are think, your kids?
Oh, 9. I mean, it makes sense.
Oh, that's
at
just
that
awesome.
Age. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. Well, you don't be stressed though. You know, I'm very aware that that's not going to work, by the way. I'm on it. But how do you get to that space as a parent? That's an incredibly hard place to get to.
So what we've done is we've broken it down into 5 steps. So the very first step is called reframing. And so let's take us as, you and I are living in an age where the stresses are really quite extraordinary.
They're pretty out there, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, really, seriously, right? So one of the things that we teach is, for example, the whole point of this field is to reframe our own behavior as well as the child's. So if I have, let's say I have this huge craving for, I don't know, butter brickle ice cream. That was my own personal weakness. And you could say, well, I'm going to exercise self-control and I'm going to force myself not to eat it. Well, that doesn't work very well, does it?
No.
So what we've done is we reframe that incredible desire. Why do I have this desire now? Why now? Remember I said, why now? And the craving for the ice cream is actually a fabulous indicator that I am really stressed. What's fascinating about this is once you reframe, if you still want the ice cream, go ahead and do it. We don't want to get into a battle of wills, but it's quite fascinating to see how often that desire disappears once you recognize what it means. So that's a first step. The second step is figure out what your stresses are. So when we talk about identifying the stresses, we don't want to just do the obvious ones, like you mentioned, you know, stress of work or time or money, but little things that we don't think of stresses, smells, visual stimulation, auditory stimulation. We talk about becoming a stress detective, trying to figure out, you know, I am really wound up today. Well, what went on? The third one is reduce the stresses. And so here, what we're going to look at is taking a very simple analogy. If I find light really stressful, turn off the lights. And in fact, we do this with children all the time when they're having a meltdown, and it has quite a significant impact in calming down their nervous system. The fourth one is become stress aware. Now, when we look at this, like we use graphs because we're scientists, and if we can't graph it, then it's not fun. And we have what we call an inverted V. And basically what that means is when you hit that peak of stress and you slide down the other side, then all bets are off. And before you know it, you're yelling at your kid or you're yelling at your spouse. We really want to know when I'm approaching the peak. It's before I get there that we want to reduce the stresses, not after the fact, because we all know it's very hard after the fact. And we want to teach that to a kid. We want to teach a kid to recognize when they are starting to become overstressed. And then the fifth step is you need to have balance in your life. And we talk about balance across five domains. So we look at it physically, and we look at it emotionally, and we look at it cognitively, all these fancy words. But basically what it means is, what are you doing daily, weekly, that you can't just say, well, I'm going to, you know, work like the Dickens, and then once a week I'm going to go camping and I'll be fine. Well, it doesn't work like that. And of course, the things that we do to restore balance are, each of us has our own secrets. So, you know, maybe for me, it's baking, or I'm actually, I like to think of myself as a runner. My children say that I'm no longer allowed to describe myself that way. I actually go out for my daily shuffle, but that's fine. I still come back and I feel balanced. So those five steps are the things that we start to do. And it's quite interesting how when we start to apply this for ourselves, then all of a sudden our capacity to do this with a child, with our own child, it just becomes an automatic. One of our sayings is calmness begets calmness.
What sort of research has there been on self-regulation? Because it feels like there's a lot of conflicting advice out there for parents, people who want to work on this kind of stuff to help themselves.
So tons of research. The research has been done in four main areas. The one I mentioned is brain science. Scientists have made discoveries over the last 20 years or even less that are, I don't know how to describe this. It's earth-shattering. So let me give you an example. We are seeing an explosion of little guys, children your age, that are developing what's called high math anxiety. And it now looks like about 50% of all children are becoming math phobic by the time they hit grade 3. Well, this is unbelievable. What's going on here? So what they did was they examined their brains while they were working on a math problem, arithmetic problems. And what they discovered was that the child's brain of these high math anxiety kids was going into fight or flight. Well, this is unbelievable. What does that mean? Mm. Well, when a child goes into fight or flight, the brain shifts into very ancient neural mechanisms, and it shuts down thinking. It shuts down the very parts of the surface of the brain that they need to learn math. They are reacting to math the way a million years ago our ancestors reacted to a dangerous animal. So having realized that, so here's a case where science made the most unbelievable discovery that no one could believe when we first saw it. It was replicated. Now we can start to figure out why. What on earth did we do to make them see math as a threat? Now, the implications of this science are staggering, because all of a sudden now we recognize that IQ is not at all what we thought. IQ is a sign that for whatever reason, our child's freezing. Our child's brain is stopping. It's applying what we call limbic brakes. So when you ask about the science, we start off with hard science, science of the brain, telling us what's going on when a child is having trouble learning or when a child's having trouble with their behavior. Then we look at the next major area of science is, we know that the brain runs on neurohormones. Now, what we're learning is that there is a certain neurohormone that is released when we are overstressed, and this neurohormone is called cortisol. And what it does is it impedes learning, emotion regulation. In fact, what happens is the child starts to look for dangers everywhere, starts to see them everywhere, even where those dangers don't exist. So it's called a negative bias, this distortion of their reality. It's very hard once it becomes entrenched. Then we have two other major sciences that we look at. Psychology is obvious. And here what's happening is, in psychology, we're taking all of these sort of classic theories that have developed over the last, say, 50 years. So we now realize that we have to reframe not just behavior, but we have to reframe what we thought we understood about things like attachment, having a bonded relationship with the child. We have to reframe it in terms of what's going on in these deep parts of the brain, in the part below the surface, in the limbic system. And then finally, we look at something called psychophysiology, and that's actually my own favorite. This is the work of a guy called Steve Porges. He will get the Nobel. He deserves the Nobel. And basically what we are learning is, and here the experiments are just astonishing in their complexity and their beauty. And what we've learned is that even something like a baby's temperament, you think, my child's born with such and such a temperament. In fact, what we've now learned is that temperament is a sign of how much stress the baby is under. A baby that is under too much physiological stress has what we would call a difficult temperament. So can I put all that together for you?
Oh, you certainly did. And we've run out of time. Dr. Stuart Shanker, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Stuart Shanker has been my guest in the drawing room. He's the founder of the Merit Center and the Self-Regulation Institute, and was in Australia as a guest of the Early Childhood Australia National Conference.